Welcome to Joy Connection, your journey to well-balanced living podcast series. Please welcome your host, Ralph Weaver.
Hi, I'm Ralph Weaver, and welcome to EWC Joy Connection, Journey to Well-Balanced Living. Thank you for being here. Today's session highlights the importance of seeking psychosocial support during the cancer journey. Getting a cancer diagnosis is devastating to most people who often don't know where to turn to for help and assistance. Medical terms are coming fast and furious, and decisions about one's health must be made often at times where the patient is uninformed. Today is about empowering patients and caregivers to know their options as they start the cancer journey. That is where Crossroads for Hope comes in. Their promise is that all those affected by cancer, people with cancer and their loved ones, should have a safe place to turn for emotional and social support programs and services at no charge. The incredible mission of this organization would not be possible without our guest, Amy Sutton, Crossroads for Hope's CEO. I have the pleasure of working with Amy as the chair of the Board of Trustees for Crossroads for Hope. Amy is a passionate and committed leader. She is here today to shed light on her experience with Crossroads for Hope, as well as discussing the cancer journey and where families and patients turn to after receiving their diagnosis. Please welcome Amy Sutton.
Thank you, Ralph, for that introduction. That was wonderful, and it's great to be with you today.
You're quite welcome. We're glad to have you here. And Amy, I'd like to just start out with a question about, just tell us about the beginning of the organization and the evolution of the organization today.
Our organization was founded by four women in the community, all of whom had had professional and personal connections to cancer. They believe that social and emotional support is an essential part of cancer care, and they wanted to make sure that there was a safe place in the community that people could go to access that care for their family members and themselves at no charge. So they actually began as an organization called Hope Springs, and they were guided very early on to an affiliate with a national organization, which they did, and one that allowed them to stay independent. We continued to gain experience in the cancer support space. Since 2001, we have been delivering psychosocial support services that create activation in both individuals and family members who are dealing with a cancer diagnosis, helping them move through a health crisis caused by cancer to become activated and empowered with the behaviors that allow them to take control of their health and care. We have seen the changes in the cancer landscape since the 80s, you know, looking at this issue, since the beginning of patient activation models that were being implemented in communities across the country. And today, the cancer experience is complicated. It is costly. There are fewer and fewer resources available for people to access. And so it's with that lens and the desire to maintain the vision of our founders that we ended a licensing agreement with our national organization and became Crossroads for Hope, a network of cancer support in 2021. But we are a little over a year as a completely independent organization and are innovating and growing the reach of these services each and every day.
And Amy, I'm curious, when did your journey with the organization begin? If I'm not mistaken, it's been almost 10 years?
Started with the organization in 2012. I had worked in industry in strategic human resources, helping organizations transform and helping people in those organizations transform as well to be able to deliver performance results in organizations. And I left industry to try to make a difference in the community. And I started working at a hospice and was able to see the healthcare system downstream, and it was broken. You know, people were entering end-of-life care with tremendous amounts of distress. And it really stuck with me that, you know, that's not that's not what we want for people. We want patients and families to have a high quality of life across their entire life and beyond in bereavement for families. So I saw people at that stage of a health crisis and then moved on to run the Red Cross in Somerset County, handling some of the largest disasters prior to Hurricane Sandy. And again, helping people in crisis. In this case, it was a disaster. And ended up coming here in 2012. And when I look back at my experiences, I'm left with the thought that when people get access to psychosocial support services at the point at which they're dealing with crisis, they can move through that crisis much more effectively than without those services. And so coming to cancer in this industry, my life has been touched by cancer. I wish my family had known about these services when they were dealing with those issues. But now I can do something about that to make sure that everyone has access to the emotional and social support that they need to live with through and beyond cancer.
So, Amy, if you talk about the evolution over the 10 years, how would you say where we are today in comparison to where we were 10 years ago?
You know, it's interesting. Dr. Harold Benjamin had created a model in the early 80s that was the precursor to the patient advocacy movement. But it was a model that was dependent upon people coming to the organization delivering that support. And it was very much delivered in a small group setting or individually. And you couldn't scale that model. Over the last 10 years, what's become very apparent as the healthcare system has transformed is that psychosocial support has not. And we're on a mission to change that. We're on a mission to transform the cancer experience for all those affected by making sure that everyone has access to these services as early as possible to really help improve their cancer journey along the continuum of care.
Amy, can you tell us about the kinds of services that are offered by Crossroads for Hope?
When someone is diagnosed or they're dealing with a family member's diagnosis and they're finding themselves in somewhat of a crisis with their situation, our social work and child life team is able to help individuals deal with the distress caused by cancer and help to navigate resources. Oftentimes, there's many unmet needs that need to be addressed, and we can either provide those services or connect people to resources in the community. So I think the first thing we do is help people move through the distress caused by a cancer health crisis. We then have programs that help inform and educate individuals about the cancer experience, as well as nutrition. And we also have programs that help people gain skills to manage distress and their well-being. We've taken this program and digitized it using an AI-based platform that allows us to scale it and integrate it into clinical workflows. And we're working hard in the community to connect with underserved communities to bring our program to them that enable them to be on the first line of response in the community when somebody is diagnosed, to support individuals and get them connected to resources like ours.
And Amy, what I've been impressed by is the fact that the services are not only for the person undergoing the treatment for their cancer diagnosis, but maybe it is a child that's having a difficulty accepting that their parent is sick, or maybe there are others in the family that need assistance with how they can become an effective caregiver. So can you just talk a little bit about how you treat the total well-being of the family?
Well, what we know from the research is that a patient's cancer experience is very much dependent on the support they have around them, and not just caregivers, but family members. It doesn't seem logical to just deal with the patient when families operate as a unit. And so we look at the cancer experience from the patient's perspective, the family member's perspective, and the family member based on the age of the individuals who are affected. So oftentimes there's children in the home who are aware that something's wrong, but mom and dad are not in a position to explain or talk about the disease and its impact on their lives as a family. And so we use child life in those situations to really help support the family as a unit. What I don't think people are aware of is the scope of the issue. And when you think of New Jersey, there are 52,000 people a year being newly diagnosed. There's about 534,000 people living with a history of cancer in the state. And of those numbers, 25% of those individuals are raising children under the age of 19. So it's complicated for families, and no one is prepared for a cancer diagnosis. And that's why we're here, is to help people through that process.
How do you deal with people that want to maintain their privacy, or they feel as though a diagnosis, when they have a diagnosis of cancer, they don't want to share it with anyone, and so they don't seek help? What advice would you give to someone, a newly diagnosed person, that may feel that way initially?
Well, we've seen it time and time again that people come to this, the work that we do, and find great benefit from being connected to others who share an experience. They find support, they learn from one another. But what's important is that we deliver support that's relevant to the person, not what we think is important. And that's why, you know, we have this digital program called My Go-To Support that allows people to get seamless psychosocial support services and resources direct to their mobile device in their lived environment, never having to participate in a group if they don't want to do that. And yet they can still access support and resources in their home. So it's incumbent upon us to make sure that we're delivering relevant programs and services based on the needs of individuals in a very personalized and tailored way. But I do really encourage people to consider a group model of support, because the benefits far outweigh the initial worry that people have when they come into an organization and a support group. I think oftentimes people make lasting relationships and that really do help to sustain them throughout their cancer journey.
Amy, I'm wondering, why is there such a shortage of providers for psychosocial support today, when the need, as you described earlier, when the number of people being diagnosed each year is continuing to be, you know, high? Why is it that there aren't more providers of psychosocial support?
You know, it's very interesting. I was just telling somebody the other day that, you know, the WHO in 1948 put out a statement that addressing the psychosocial needs of individuals in their care was as important as treating the disease or infirmity that they were dealing with. 1948. It was recognized that psychosocial support and addressing the human needs that people have in response to a disease was critical. And, you know, other organizations like the Institute of Medicine and NCCN have also come out and endorsed that statement as well. It's complicated. Cancer has become very complicated. It has become complex. It has become costly. And when you consider the cancer landscape, you know, think of a pyramid. At the top, there's many, many organizations trying to cure this disease. In the middle are the institutions trying to treat the disease. At the base of the pyramid is the foundation and the community in which people live. That's where we are. And our hope is to really elevate the voice of patients and their families and communities into healthcare. And that's why we're taking innovative approaches with public health and technology to really scale these programs and services. I do think that's one of the major challenges. It's been hard to scale individual, small group psychosocial support programs and integrate that into clinical workflows. And those are the types of things that we're on a mission to take on and challenge and deal with.
And what you just described, I'm still on the 1948 that statement.
Me too.
It really is amazing. What differentiates your organization? And you started to say many of the things that you're doing. To me, it just truly differentiates Crossroads for Hope. But I'd love to hear in your words, what do you feel differentiates your organization?
I think what makes us unique is we are led by social work, which is a profession rooted in social justice and equal access to care and services. And through that lens and leadership, We have created an interdisciplinary team of professionals, both child life, public health, and other allied health and mental health professionals, understand the burden of cancer on all communities that are affected, and to develop relevant programs and models of outreach that bring our work to people in ways that they need it most. And so for us, you know, we're taking the 1982 Harold Benjamin model and bringing it into the 21st century. And I think based on what patients are dealing with today and their families, we all should be thinking about how to re-envision dealing with the person and their family, not just the disease. And I think, you know, we're trying to blaze that trail to really set a path forward for others to follow in how to do that.
Yeah. And that's so important. Yeah. Dealing with the person. Yeah. Because again, it when it's so often so impersonal or just about that treatment modality, and you're not even connecting with that person, how they're going to receive that information, or do they even understand that information, and how do you empower people? So when they have their first or second meeting with their physician, how can they be a partner in their care and to truly understand it?
Well, I think people have lives before cancer, and oftentimes they're very complicated. Cancer just adds additional burdens to people. So for example, if your most pressing problem is you don't have food to put on the table, or you don't have stable housing, or you're worried about your job or taking care of your family, how are you going to be in a position to take on a cancer battle, to understand the complexities of treatment options, to maintain adherence to treatment, to maintain your well-being and balance, and the worry that comes with a cancer diagnosis? You know, we expect people to just move through this experience like any other illness or health crisis, but it's not. It's life-threatening. It really creates a sense of distress and isolation for people when there's a diagnosis. And recognizing that and addressing that up front would go a long way to improving the cancer experience along the continuum of care for not just the patients, but their entire family.
Yes, because what you just said, one's life issues don't go away when you get a cancer diagnosis. It's just another issue on top of that, of what you've already been dealing with. And I was just thinking about COVID-19 and our lives over the last, 2.5 years. And how has COVID-19 impacted your organization?
We had done a lot of work prior to the pandemic to really position ourselves for the 21st century, and that included technology. And so we were able to really pivot and lean into the situation. We went virtual right from the get-go and have not stopped delivering services. And in fact, year over year, we've seen increases as high as 62% in terms of the number of people accessing our services. And we know there's far more people who need us than are getting to us, which is why we're working so hard to change that. But the challenge with the pandemic is that, you know, for the first time, everyone understood in some ways what a cancer patient deals with, right? We all experienced fear on the onset of the pandemic, worry for our families, worry about our health and whether we could access healthcare, financial worry. All of those worries are things that people are dealing with every day when there's a cancer diagnosis. And the pandemic added extra layers and barriers to accessing care, which we're just now starting to see. You know, when you think about what's happening with diagnoses, after the pandemic hit, the National Cancer Institute has determined that we should expect significant increases in the numbers of people being diagnosed because the pandemic has delayed screenings and access to treatment. So health disparities aside that existed prior to the pandemic, all of that became even more complicated during the pandemic. And so we're bracing ourselves for what's ahead and trying to position ourselves to be able to deal with the increase in need that's coming.
And one of the things that I was reminded of is, like, even a visit to the hospital or to your physician's office when a family member or caregiver was not allowed to go in, you know, because of the different the restrictions that were in place. And so I would think if someone's going through their cancer journey, just the mental state of mind, just, you're going through so much alone, or you did during the pandemic. I mean, were you seeing that or feedback that you were getting in group settings?
Yes, we did see that a lot. I think it was disheartening for people. You know, family members were waiting in parking lots, you know, not knowing what was happening. And there was a lot of loss during COVID due to COVID, even in the cancer population. A lot of people were very vulnerable. A lot of worry all around and not a lot of places that were an outlet for people to deal with that and cope and learn coping skills. So I think, you know, we've learned a lot from that. And the fact is we have to grow to meet the needs that continue to grow in the community around cancer. And I think that, you know, the pandemic is not totally over yet. You know, people with cancer are consider themselves at risk and now are navigating a world that's starting to open up when maybe they don't feel confident about that.
Yes, the mask mandates that are being relaxed. But for someone with cancer or their caregiver or because of their being immunocompromised, it's like that has to be very troubling. It's like, okay, well, what do I do to keep myself safe if I'm still undergoing treatment?
And I think the other thing is life continues even in a pandemic, right? So life goes on. People were dealing with loss for a lot of different reasons. And, you know, there was a disaster in New Jersey in the midst of all this. We had Ida and we had patients and family members in shelters and isolated due to flood waters and the storm. So technology really enabled us to stay connected to people during those crises. And that's why community-based resources are so important, is because people don't live in healthcare institutions. They live in community. And that's where they need to be able to access support and resources. And that's where we are, embedded in communities along the entire journey for as long as people need us at no charge.
And that's so important to be there for people and then at no charge. Because I think sometimes, you know, when one has insurance or maybe has a, you know, very good standard of living, you take certain things for granted. But I would imagine some of the people that you help, some of the basic things they need. You talked about, you know, having food or, you know, even paying for their treatment. Can you share with us some of those hardship stories that may resonate, that people can have just a better understanding of what a lot of people are going through today?
Mm-hmm. Well, when you think about the pandemic and access to food, for example, we got a call very early on from a woman who was a cancer patient, and she had advanced cancer, and she used to use the delivery services from her local grocery store because she was concerned just in general about going out and about in the community. When the pandemic happened, those resources were all cut off. You know, so then she was left with not being able to access food. That's somebody who has access to resources, who's having access to food issues, right? And she didn't have family and friends to help her with that. So, you know, we helped her navigate that situation, but there's others who literally don't have access to food. There's people, you know, it's interesting. I was looking recently at some of the rates of financial toxicity, which is, you know, people dealing with financial burdens related to healthcare, for example. And cancer patients are 2.5 times more likely to file for bankruptcy, even today after a diagnosis. The cost of healthcare is expensive. And people, even today, with Affordable Health Care Act and other things, are having to make decisions between treatment and food, work and treatment. No. In the end, what we're seeing is, especially in underserved communities, that people are often walking away from treatable cancers. And that's something that, you know, our public health team, along with child life and social work, are working to address. is to breaking down the barriers and the massive amounts of unmet needs that exist in communities across New Jersey, across the nation, that are preventing people timely access to care. Because in the end, if they don't access care for whatever reason, they don't have enough money, they don't have transportation, whatever the issue is, if they do not get screened, if they do not get timely access to care, they're ending up with advanced cancers and a higher likelihood of death and unnecessary deaths. That doesn't have to be the case. One of the things that we're doing is really helping to align efforts in the community, both from a social service, public health, and health perspective, to really focus our efforts in helping to break down the barriers to care that exist in communities. There's a human impact to that. There's an economic impact to that. And it doesn't have to be. So that's what we're working to address.
Tell us a little bit more about some of the outreach initiatives that you have underway.
Yes. So public health and integrating that profession on our team has been transformative in terms of really understanding the burden of cancer in underserved populations and helping us to tailor the most relevant aspects of what we do for individuals living in those communities. It looks like educational workshops that we're doing in the community. It looks like the development of partnerships with trusted organizations in the community that we can work with to try to transfer knowledge and skills and resources to the front lines of this disease, which is in communities where people live and work. And so oftentimes people in schools or people in faith-based organizations are the first people to know that somebody's been affected by cancer in the community. So it's really important that we activate them with the skills, knowledge, and resources to respond when they become aware of that and make referrals to organizations like ours to be able to access resources early on in their disease. And so we have very tailored initiatives. For example, we're working to develop a model within the Black faith-based community called the Gladiator Program, where we're really empowering and activating health champions to be those frontline responders in their community, helping patients and families access resources and be able to effectively engage with their healthcare team. And so we're looking to really pilot that and get that rolled out to scale in the state and potentially beyond.
Now, that's wonderful. And what I've been impressed by is the fact that you just didn't go into communities of color and say, this is what you need. You had different listening sessions or focus groups and to talk with people. And I think that that is really distinguishes your organization, and it makes a, I think, a difference in the kinds of programs that you're doing.
I credit that a lot to the fact that our program is led by social work and integrates, you know, disciplines like child life and public health. We start with the person who is the expert in their life and cancer experience. And then we need to find ways that make our work relevant for that individual or that community. And so I think it's through that lens and leadership that you're seeing the approach that really is about elevating the community voice and the people in that those communities to really say what they need so that we can help address their needs and not tell them what they need, because it's not for us to say that. They need to say what they need, and we need to try to address those needs to the best that we can.
As a Bedminster, New Jersey headquartered organization, how do you reach others who may not reside in the area? I know you mentioned the technology that you have and people going online to find out about your services, but what else are you doing in that area?
Yeah, well, the pandemic really accelerated those efforts. Because the work that we're doing is so relevant to so many people, we've had participation in educational workshops, for example, from all over the world, as far away as China and, you know, as local as Canada and across the United States. Our psychosocial programs, we're reaching people across the United States who are seeking out services and finding us. You know, we're working on a more systemic process to grow the reach of this organization in ways that keep us connected to community, but also scale the ability for people to access us when they need us most.
And Amy, how do you get support, or where is the support for your programs, all this great work that's being done?
Yeah, we're primarily funded through philanthropy, so individual philanthropy and then institutional philanthropy through grants and sponsorships. We're working to expand that and to think about how program-related fees from institutions who are using programs like the MyGo to Support program can also help sustain the growth of this organization as well. But our primary source of funding is through philanthropy.
Now, if you had to look to the next 5 years, what do you see your organization, the role that your organization will play, and what will your organization be doing at that time?
It's my hope that we can provide a roadmap for others to do what we're doing here in New Jersey, and we're trying to scale nationally, which is elevate patients and families and their voices into healthcare in ways that ensure they have access to the psychosocial support services they need as early as possible in their cancer journey. And we understand that this is hard work, right? If it was easy, it would have been done 50 years ago, and it's not. So we're doing something that's highly innovative and unique, but it's worth every effort, because in the end, these are people's lives. And they are worth every effort that we're putting into this to see if we can help improve their quality of life and health outcomes through the integration of psychosocial support in their care and in their communities. So I think that my hope is that we can lead the way to changing a healthcare system that has been primarily driven by treatments and breakthroughs in cancer treatments, and not necessarily in how we deal with the people who need to access those treatments. And so that's my hope for this organization, is to really play a leadership role and to scale the impact of what we're doing each and every day in communities across the country.
And Amy, based on your words today, I'm sure many of our listeners will say, how do I get involved with an organization like Crossroads for Hope? What would you tell someone that would like to volunteer or lend financial support? What would you recommend they do?
I think they should start by visiting our website at crossroadsforhope.org and seeing the different ways in which we're making an impact, and considering what really resonates with them and how they would like to do that, whether it's philanthropically or through volunteering. You know, donating time and passion to this organization will make a huge difference in people's lives. So that's what I would recommend. Individuals can also give us a call at 908-658-5400 and talk to somebody about the ways in which they can really help make a difference in the community.
Well, when I talk about Crossroads for Hope, I often say passion, the passion of the people, of your passion, the passion of the social workers, your team of people there on the board of trustees. And I'm just curious as to, how do you find your passion to continue the work that you're doing?
Every day, I'm in touch with the real stories of people who come to us and who benefit from the work of this organization. And so when you realize there's something that can help people, you know, how many hours would you dedicate to making that possible for everyone to be able to access who needs it? You know, so this is not a job for anybody who works here. This is a mission. And we're trying to mobilize people on our mission to really transform the cancer experience. So, you know, at the end of the day, it's about leaving a legacy behind. And I hope the work that I've done here and others have done here is going to do that, and that we've stewarded the legacy of our founders in ways that would make them proud and stay true to their vision for this organization. It's very easy to be motivated and talk about this work with others and help to motivate them, but we need more people to help us. And so hopefully there's people out there listening to this who decide after hearing this that they want to get involved. And so, just like you did, Ralph, after our conversation, it was very easy for us to ask you to get involved. I mean, you didn't even hesitate.
No, I didn't. And it has been a pleasure to do whatever I can do for the organization. I'm just also wondering about, you know, different corporations, when you look at our state, New Jersey, just the number of life sciences companies, pharmaceutical companies in the state. I'm curious, are they providing support to you as well? What are they doing?
We do receive support from industry. I think that we would benefit from more support from more businesses, to be very honest. You know, when you think about the numbers of people who are affected by this disease, not just in terms of patients, but their family members and children, they have employees who have been touched by this disease. And this is a benefit to them to have in the state and have access to. So I really encourage businesses to talk about us, talk to us about philanthropy and ways in which we can partner to bring these services to their employees when they need it most.
And that is so important. And I've often shared, I know with you, Amy, and other friends, about you know, just my own personal story in terms of my sister who was diagnosed 30 some years ago with breast cancer. And I remember at the time not knowing what to do. And there was not an organization that could provide information to us at the time, or the organizations that were around, they gave you a brochure. And this was before the internet. So to have an organization with the personal approach that you take in dealing with the psychosocial issues, when I reflect on what our experience was like, how, and you said this earlier for even your family, the difference that it would have made to us at that time. So I am just so thankful for the work that you're doing today to make a difference in the lives of just others and passing on that knowledge and extending that helping hand. We end our podcast on a discussion, a segment that's called The Shift to Joy, asking our guests what brings them joy and makes them happy. So, Amy, what do you do to bring your joy into your life?
Well, you know, it's interesting. First of all, I think family is so important. You know, being with family, especially the pandemic, has really highlighted it is important to be with the people that you love. And so that brings me joy. But I would say that it's also feeling as if I'm making a difference. I think everybody deep down inside just wants to know that what they do makes a difference, whether it's in their family's lives or the community. And I think even when it's hard work, it's something that you can sit back and look at and say, you know, it was worth it. And so I do find joy in the work and my colleagues and finding laughter, even in very difficult situations. And so I think for me, it's an approach to life, which is I feel very blessed. And in feeling blessed, I feel very responsible to give back and make sure others were elevating people in their lives as well.
Now that well said. And Amy, I know another topic that brings you joy, and that is the building that I know was the Capitol campaign. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
We had envisioned a space on our property where we could deliver vital services around nutrition and services for children who are affected by cancer and their families. And so that vision is finally taking shape, and we're getting ready to launch a new building on our property that will allow us to have technology to stream nutrition education and programming and to create a safe place for kids to access support. The Mark Lipschitz Center for Family and Nutrition is hopefully going to break ground this summer. And it's coming as a result of efforts of many, many people who believe in this work and want to make sure that more people have access to the work that we do each and every day. So it's very exciting. And our little campus here is growing in Bedminster, but its tentacles are reaching far, far away from here in places across the country and potentially globally. And so it's an exciting time to be part of the organization and to see this come to fruition.
That's great. Amy, is there anything else you'd like to mention before we wrap up today?
No, I think I just want to thank you, Ralph, for number one, giving us the opportunity to share our story with others and for the work that you do each and every day in the community. It's individuals like yourself who provide leadership on so many different levels, but especially to our organization, that makes our work easier and helps us accomplish the goals and visions that we have for this organization. So thank you and your team for making this possible.
You're welcome. But thanks to you, Amy, and for taking the time today from your busy schedule to chat with us. I know this session can help a lot of people. And please check out crossroadsforhope.org and see their events and resources. Thank you for listening today. And please don't forget to share the podcast link to your friends and family. Also, we love to see your comments and thoughts, so please keep them coming. Don't forget to take a little time to spread some joy today.